Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, in this half, Jay Leno, an intimate interview. Lots of really crazy old stories and information. I think you're really going to learn to love this guy after you hear this. And Chael Sonnen comes in on Good Sports as well. And that guy, he's a real talent. And he was a great fighter, too. Anyway, LifeLock, hacker group called Shiny Hunters, breached 73 million user records from dating apps, delivery services, online stores, newspapers, and they're selling them on the dark web. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our info at risk out on the internet. Cybercriminals keep finding new ways to steal your identity. Protect yourself with LifeLock, the leader in identity theft protection. Detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they find out you've been compromised, they will send you an alert. They're LifeLock. Right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
Even people who disagree on everything agree on Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. Jay Leno says, Adam Carolla is the sort of blue-collar, sit-at-the-end-of-the-bar sort of intellectual I enjoy. With an impressive lexicon of metaphors and cultural references, he paints hilarious pictures that will keep you entertained for hours. I really enjoyed this book. Pre-order I'm Your Emotional Support Animal now at adamcarolla.com.
All right, Jay Leno has joined me because I asked Jay Leno to join me, and he was nice enough to join me.
And you were nice enough to do my show, and you won the race, so you did it.
I love Jay Leno's Garage. I'll give you all the official particulars on that show in a moment. Or Jay can. Give us all times and dates for Jay Leno's
Well, it's
Garage.
CNBC, 10 o'clock and 7 o'clock California time.
And, and just TiVo it like I do. I watch every week.
Yeah,
So I had this thought about you specifically, which is I've been thinking a lot about fear and people's relationship with fear.
Yeah.
And it's great these days. A lot of people are having a big sort of fear orgy. And I thought, I'm not fear-based. I know that sounded bizarre, but I'm not a fear-based person. And I thought, Jay Leno is not fear-based. And
no.
I watch what you do, and I see what you do, but I don't know how you got that way or if you were always that way.
No, I think I was always that way. I'm not a panicky person, you know. Whenever I know I'm going to crash, I just go limp and relax and let it happen. I don't tense up, you know. I remember when I was at Talladega, we were doing 100 laps at 190 miles an hour trying to break this record with the Carrera GT, the Porsche.
Yeah.
And, you know, up to about lap 100, I'm coming down the straight and the guy gives me the thumbs up. I went, oh, great. And I just lifted my foot off the throttle and whoosh, the rear end came around. Just spun eight times. But I always remember that old adage, you always hit what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at the wall, you'll hit the wall. So as soon as I saw the wall, I kept the wheel. Then I saw the wall again. I just kept cutting the wheel. And I spun down the center of the track, and it was okay. And I realized, oh, all right. So that was about as scary as it gets, and it wasn't that bad. So,
well, I was watching. I famously, when you had the Hemi under glass rollover.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And you know, the thing rolled violently, and then soon as it came to a stop, Jay just turned to the driver and went, you okay? And I thought, oh, Jay,
well, the funniest thing was the medic runs over and says to the driver, what's your name? How old are you? He goes, I'm Bob Riggle, 81 years old. And he taps me, he goes, what's your name? How old are you? And I said, I'm Bob Riggle, and I'm 81 years old. One of these two men is the real Bob Riggle. You have to, you know, and they got a big laugh, and it's pretty funny.
But that wiring, and I think nobody wants to get injured or killed, but I still kind of wish that wiring upon my kids, you know, that calm sort of that I'm willing to go out and put myself in danger without being a daredevil.
Right. I know what you mean. Yeah. I'm not a panicky type person. I had this argument with somebody the other day that got mad and threw something and broke something. I'm like, well, why'd you throw it? Because I'm mad. Mm-hmm. Well, but what does it do? I don't understand why you would break something. How does that now make it better? It doesn't. It's not logical, you know.
Right. But it's funny that the logic is in kind of short supply and the logical people are kind of few and far between. Do you think that your disposition is aided by the fact that you live in a mechanical world? I have this theory that everyone is drifting into it. So I think what's happening is people don't have a relationship with danger because they sit in a cubicle all day and they kind of look at a computer screen, and you climb under a Stanley steamer with a blowtorch.
You know, it's interesting you say that because speed is the only new sensation of the 20th century. If you put a baby in a room and turn out the light, the baby will cry. But you take the same baby, put him on the hood of a car and go 70 miles an hour, there's no fear because there's no inherent fear of speed, because evolutionary-wise, I think it's still fairly new. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have years of being chased by dinosaurs or whatever it might be, or darkness is scary. So you don't have that. So it becomes, yeah, it's a learned experience.
Right. And I think that, and I don't want to speak for the guys at your shop, but I've found that my blue-collar friends have a better relationship with fear, and then as it pertains to, like, pandemics and stuff, they sort of react differently than my Hollywood friends.
Oh, that's definitely true. Yeah, oh, yeah, that's hilariously true.
Right.
Yeah, because your Hollywood friends are just idiots.
Right.
They just don't – they're thinking about, well, how's this going to affect my show next week? Or it's not – It's something – they think it's something greater than themselves, you know. I would agree with that. That's why most of my friends are, quote, as you call them, mechanical friends, because there's a logic to it as to why something happens a certain way, you know. I mean, I know people are afraid of guns because they could just go off.
Right.
Well, they don't. Right. You understand how it works. There's a certain amount of pressure here. Unless it's made in China out of some pot metal that's going to disintegrate – it's not just going to go off. You learn how to handle it and how to use it, you know. So, yeah, that's funny that you said. Or fire. Fire is another one. You know, I know people that – well, here's a perfect example. I drove one of my steam cars into the gas station. And for those who don't know, you use gasoline to heat the water, and the water makes steam, and then you proceed like a train. And this lady goes, hey, your car's smoking. I said, oh, thank you. But it's not smoke. It's steam. What do you mean? It's a steam car. It runs on steam. And she goes, yeah, right. I go, no, it does. She goes, why are you putting gas in it? I said, we're putting gas in it because the gasoline heats the water like it would in a stove and makes it hot. And she goes, well, why don't you just leave it in the sun? I said, well, if the sun could boil water, I don't even think we'd be having this conversation. We wouldn't be talking. And she looked at me like I was making all this up. It just made me laugh. It's just very funny.
It's a sort of a detachment from mechanics, science. There's a math that's falling by the wayside, and it's kind of hurting us as a society. The way I wish people were more tangible, go out in the garage and
yeah, that's funny to me. Because let me lose this. Here. I'm on the phone. I'm doing the podcast quite late. That makes me laugh because, you know, I always hear these ads on the radio. Today, people are concerned about value. Yeah, like my parents just threw money in the street. They had no idea. But you realize someone who grew up in the 20s, you were better able to cope with the world you live in because you could fix the tractor, you could fix the car, you could grow your own food, you could, in a pinch, you knew how to use manure for fuel, whatever it might be. You could control your own destiny.
Right.
Now people, the power goes out and people just, you know, they just panic. They don't know what to do, you know.
Do you think your lack of fear for lack of a better title for what you possess? I'm the same way. When the car goes out of control, I have to be told sometimes not to let go of the steering wheel.
Like, right.
I just give it up. I did a race once, or I worked with an instructor once, and he kept saying to me, He said, you got to hold on to the wheel with both hands. You can't have one hand out, you know, the window of the cigarette and hold on with the other hand. Like, but he did say to me, you're the most relaxed person I've ever seen drive a car. And I thought, well, the intensity just makes you a worse driver. I think.
Paul Newman was the most relaxed person I ever saw.
Really?
Paul Newman came to the Tonight Show, and we were filming over here, you know, where we used to do it over in Burbank. And by that time, every show had left. So they're like 25 or 30 sound stages. So you literally had these corridors that were almost half a mile long. It's
cavernous.
Cavernous. Yeah. So we decided to do a go-kart race. And if I was going to race Paul Newman, I think I told you this once before.
It's in the documentary.
Yeah, and Paul gets in there, and he's, what, 81 or whatever it was. So calm. I'm working my ass off trying to keep up with him. And he just flamed. I mean, he literally just – I mean, he just – you know, and I'm just cutting the wheel too much. I'm sliding too much. I'm hitting the wall. I'm bouncing. And just the most relaxed, calm guy. And we did it like three times to see if I could get him. I never did get him. He was that good.
Well, I drove with Jay the other week, and it's on Jay Leno's Garage.
Oh, yeah,
and Jay's a fast driver. Jay went all out in that Z car over Fontana, and you'd never been on that track before.
No, well, that's the thing about this show. It's so low budget. You hear your first time on the track, first time in the car. Go! I go to the race. Well, I don't get a practice lap. No, right. No, just go, go. You know. So
do you think being on stage and being a comedian? Do you think the fear, the lack of fear, or the good relationship with fear has aided you in that endeavor as well?
Oh, I think so. I remember once I was on stage, and a beer bottle went flying past my head and smashed behind me. And I said, who did that? It's what coward threw that? And this enormous guy stands up. Because I had a couple of drinks. And he looked at me and goes, look, I'm really sorry. Don't have it again. You know, and now I realize. I really felt bad. But the guy was enormous. I went, oh, my God, if this guy comes out, I'm dead. I'm sorry. I behaved very badly. I apologize. All right, you're forgiven. Sit down. Anybody else?
You know, where was that?
That was in the Improv. Yeah.
Out here?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. What circa what year would you say?
Oh, 80s, late 80s.
Did God? I mean, you were with everyone. You saw everyone. Those legendary stories. The Comedy Store back in the day, and Letterman and Leno and everybody. And
Richie Pryor. There was nobody better. You know, it's funny. I say Richie Pryor because we called him Richie. And people go to me, yeah, why do you call him Richie? It's Richard. He was Richie Pryor then. I mean, that's what it was. And to me, that's how, you know, comics are inherently pretty lazy. You tend to go to where you know you do well.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying to Mitzi, and Richard was in – he was rehearsing for Live on the Sunset Strip. It was going to be one of the first. This is before they videotaped comics or did any of that stuff. He was making a stand-up film.
Right.
And he was working it out every night at the Comedy Store. And I said to Mitzi, could I follow him every night just to see? And he would go up, blow the people like, ha, ha, ha. I mean, laughing so hard. Good night, everybody, good night. And he'd run off the stage, you know. And they go, please welcome Jay Leno. And I realized at that point, I didn't have an hour's worth of material. I had about 16 minutes or 17 minutes. And I was taping it every night, and it just threw out everything that didn't get a laugh. Because, you know, nothing funny you're talking to comics. Like, why are you still doing that Nixon's not a crook bit? Well, I mean, it worked the other night. I know, but the last 40 nights, it didn't work. You just happened to have a really old audience tonight who knew what you were talking about.
Right.
You know, there's that tendency to never want to give up anything. And that made me just clean house and throw a bunch of material out. So it was a good lesson.
So going after someone who may have been the best to ever do it.
Yeah.
But you sought that out, right? I mean, you wanted to go after him.
Oh, yeah. And he was the best. I mean, it's really different. I mean, he was the first guy, not the first, but one of the first to use obscenities not in a way that would be gratuitous, you know. It was a part of the vernacular, it was a part of the character. You really, when he did a character. He really became that character and talked like that character and was really, really funny. You know, he had the perfect, in the sense that Mike Tyson had the perfect background to be a fighter, horrible childhood, parents mistreated, you know, the whole, the anger. Richie had the same thing, grew up in a whorehouse in, was it Des Moines, I think it was?
I know the hard scrabble.
Yeah. Yeah. And, just all the elements, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about Tyson as we were talking about the old days of the Comedy Store, and it's interesting that a club has a sort of cycle to it, like the heavyweight division. You know, you think about the heavyweight division with Ali and Frazier,
right?
Foreman and all that, and then you get to the sort of early 80s and it's a bunch of guys you never heard of, right, and you don't really care anymore, and then at some point Tyson comes around, and in a weird way a comedy club can have that. It can have that early days with you and Letterman and Richie Pryor and all the same, and Sam Kennison later and all this stuff, and then at some point, I don't know, dries up a little, none of the it has a little lull, and then there's a reawakening, and it has, like, if you looked at it on a chart, it could look like the heavyweight division.
Yeah, it's funny, you don't really think of it that way when you're going through it. It just seems like another day, you know. I always say the trick to life is to know you're in heaven before you get cast out of it. And that was sort of the way I felt there. This was perfect. We didn't make a lot of money or anything, but you got an accolade from your peers, from the audience. There'd be little quips in the press and all that kind of stuff. And every now and then Carson or Steve Martin or somebody would drop by to see who the hot new comic was. You know, it was a wonderful time. It really was. It was a fabulous time.
So you came out at what age?
I came out in 72. I was still in college. I was going back and forward. Permanently from 73 on. Yeah.
When did it hit you that you come from a, you know, pretty regular environment?
Very regular environment.
And so stand-up comedy seems, it's not Richard Pryor. Your early years were different than Richard Pryor's.
Oh, yeah. I can remember my mom talking to my aunt, and she must say, "What's Jay doing now?" And my mother's from Scotland. "Well, Jay, he has a little skit that he puts on from town to town. He goes to different towns and does a skit." And I go, "No, Mom, I don't really do a skit there." I mean, they never really understood what it is I did.
Were they around long enough to see the kind of of your success?
Oh, yeah, they made it to the first couple of years of The Tonight Show. To me, that's the saddest thing, people who don't. You know, that happened to Paul Newman. Paul Newman was 24, and his dad said, "Get a goddamn job." He told me this story. "You know, you're this, you're a bum, you're this acting thing is stupid. You're just, you know, on and on." And his father died, and literally the next year, he was the biggest star in the world.
I do. I feel this exact same way when I talk to athletes who, you know, played in the World Series or won the Super Bowl or something, and right, they go, "Oh, my dad passed away." I go, "God, but was he around long enough to see you?"
Right. I mean, to me, Paul Newman's one is the saddest, because it just, you're that close. You know, my dad was 43 when I was born.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was always jealous. I remember being really jealous of Howie Mandel, because Howie's dad was like 19 years old, something like that. And he would bring his dad to the Comedy Store. And his dad was like 48 or 50. And it was like, I wish I could do this with my dad. And then sadly, Howie's dad just, I think, had a massive stroke or heart attack and died. And I went, "Oh, man, just be careful what you wish for. You know, you just don't know." And I realized, because you know how it is, you're always jealous when people have their parents longer than you had yours, you know.
Well, it's sort of be careful who you compare yourself to. Like, you really don't know what their past is and what's next. And it's easy to kind of go, "That guy's got it so good over there. I'm struggling over here."
Well, it's funny you said. I had a comic who was nameless, not famous, but he said to me, you know, he's grousing about the fact that he was not. Oh, let me do this. I'm doing a podcast. Call back.
I like that technique. Okay. I'm going to do that even when I'm driving and my mom calls.
And what was I talking about? This comic said to me, well, you know, you and Seinfeld and Letterman, you were lucky. You grew up during the golden age of comedy when it was easy. And I go, it wasn't any easier. It's always the same. It's not any easier. It's just the most ridiculous comment.
Yeah, it's in a way, it's like saying it was easier to make the Celtics in, 1961 or something. Well, the game may be different, but it wasn't easier. It
was still professional sports. You know, you can only live in the time you live in. I hate these things where, well, I think Muhammad Ali could not have been beaten by whoever it might be, or
right.
Some modern fighter.
They do it with race car drivers.
Yeah, they don't live in the same time. They don't live in the same era, different machinery. I mean, something that I thought was really fascinating, and they did this with race car drivers. They took some of today's racers and put them in some cars from the 50s and earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, my God, this is, like, scariest, because the brakes,
right.
I mean, they're obviously reactions are as sharp as ever, but the car is not. It doesn't stop when you press in the brakes. You've got to use the transmission. You've got to put it into a bit of a slide to scrub off some speed. There's just all different techniques, you know. So you just live in the time you live in.
So you come out. You're going – what are you studying in college at that point?
What am I studying? I remember going to Emerson, and my parents wanted me to go to college, and I don't go to college. And I took speech therapy because it said at the end of the semester, each student would be required to give a 20-minute talk. And I remember guys going, I got to talk, but I can't talk. I said, well, I can talk for 20 minutes. Jesus, okay, give me that one. I'll sign up for that one. I paid no attention in college. I didn't have any interest in it. At that point, I was working clubs and trying to be a comedian. I would go to class during the day, and I would drive from Boston, New York, almost every night to try and get on at the improv and be back in school the next day. And if something wasn't on the test, I wasn't interested in it. But I somehow graduated. To this day, I have no idea how that happened, but I did graduate. But I can say I got a lot out of it. But that being said, I made connections and I made friends. And I realized, because see, when I grew up, I was the only comedian I'd ever met. I never met anybody who wanted to do comedy for a living. I mean, there were people that did skits in school, but no, you can't. It didn't even occur to me. I remember Mrs. Langdell, our next door neighbor, said, you can't be a comedian unless your father was a comedian. That's the way it works in Hollywood, you know. Once you go out there, if your father wasn't a comedian, you can't be. You know, this is the only business where people know nothing about it. Feel free to give advice, you know.
Sure.
And I thought, oh, man, well, my dad wasn't a comedian. How am I ever going to make it here, you know? So it was very funny.
When I met Jay when I was 20 or so, maybe 21, trying to think. It's funny. I grew up out here in North Hollywood, but I didn't know any comedians, and I didn't know how anything worked either. And I spotted Jay, as I've told you guys, living in the house across from the house I was working on.
Right.
Up in the hills off like Woodrow Wilson up there.
Del Zorro.
Yeah. And I was working on a house, and I was putting stucco on the outside of the house. And the thing that's kind of weird about stucco, I guess stucco, like putting stucco on is sort of like riding a horse. Like if the horse knows you're a novice and knows you're scared, it does what it does.
Right.
But if it respects you. And so the thing that's weird about stucco is you mix it up and you put on a hawk and you get a trowel. And the guy knows how to spread stucco, puts it up and just spreads it on. It just goes on like cream cheese on a bagel. And then he goes, you try. And then you do it, and it all just falls off.
Right.
You just did the exact same thing he did, but it doesn't work. So I was outside this house trying to spread stucco on this window, and I was watching the neighbor, who was Jay. And I think you may have been renting that house at
the time. No, I bought that house.
You bought that house. What year did you buy that house?
1980.
How long were you in that house for?
6 years.
6 years. So this must have been about 83,
right,
82,
right.
83.
It was, yeah.
And I was just watching this guy's schedule. It was a real tight street. It was a narrow street. I even think that the couple whose house I was working on with the contractor was just a guy, me and another guy named Tom Johnson. I think at some point they asked if they could park their car in your driveway or something like that to make room for the truck or
some
version of that. And you had the big Buick Roadmaster back then.
Still got it.
and all the motorcycles were in the garage.
Right.
I can picture the house right now. It's like a driveway. The Buick was sort of in the back of the driveway. You turn right, there's the garage.
Right, right, right.
The front door's off the garage.
Right, right, right.
So I'm sitting out there, and I'm spreading stucco starting at 7 in the morning, and I'm noticing the neighbor, because I'm up on the scaffolding, just kind of, the street's narrow. It's quiet. And I see you come out and get the newspaper. And you came out, you know, mid-morning or something like that. I don't know, probably did some sets that night at the Comedy Store or Hermosa or something. And it seemed to me you came out and got the paper at 10, 11 in the morning or something, right, some version of that. And then I see you go back in the house. And I think, okay, this guy's not working. Like, he's not getting up and having to go punch the clock, and I'm still out there spreading stucco. And then at some point at noon or 1 o'clock, you'd come out and start working on the bikes in the garage. You start fiddling around with the bikes. And I remember thinking, what a schedule this guy's on.
Oh, there you go.
This guy's on a schedule. And then I recognized you. I was like, I think that's Jay Leno. I think that's the comedian. Now, this is 81, 82.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not a household name.
No, I've been on Carson and Merv and all that kind of stuff.
Right. I think I know this guy. And so I started going over after we punched out, which is like 3:30, and I started watching you, talking to you while you're working on the bikes.
Yeah, I remember thinking, well, that guy, man, he's done at work at 3:30. What a schedule that guy's got.
You got to go to work tonight.
That's
great.
I got to go to work in 4 hours.
You had the bikes with the valves on the outside of them, the valve springs on the
right,
outside
yeah,
of
yeah.
them.
Some of the older bikes, yeah.
Yeah, and you're working on those. We were talking about you having a Sunbeam Tiger.
Right, right.
And you rolling it and twisting it all up.
I rolled it 3 times. And then... Do you remember Boris, the Russian guy that lived on the other side of the house you were in? You know, when my wife and I moved in, we keep this guy, hello, everybody. My name is Boris. Hi, Boris. So Mavis says, well, why don't we meet the neighbors? Let's go down to Ralph's or on the road. Let's get one of those cakes, and we'll bring it next door as a welcome gift. So, like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I go knock on the door. Yes, Boris. Hi, Jay and Mavis, your next door neighbor. Yes. Oh, we have a little gift for you. Oh, come in. He's got a robe on. And I see the living room has no furniture, but it's got a shag carpet. He's got a camera set up, and there are two naked girls on the floor. And he goes, oh, you're busy. No, no, it's just making a movie. Come in, come in. So I have the cake. I go, hi, girls. Hello. Hi, hi. It's my wife, Mavis. Yeah, I'm being like the neighbors, you know. So I say, hey, can I put this cake? Oh, you just put it down the ground. So I put the cake on the floor, and the girls crawl over like two dogs. Cake! And they start eating the cake. You know, and the guy goes, hey, girls, don't eat the cake. You have more film too. More filming. Stop eating cake. Stop eating cake. You know, I said, well, I bought the cake for everybody. Really, it's fine. I said, my wife and I, we got to go. No, no, wait. The girls go in the other room. I went to talk. And then we talk for a little. I go, this is Hollywood. I'm really living in Hollywood now. They're shooting a porn movie next door, and I put it on the floor, and the girls crawl over and eat the cake. I mean, hilarious.
I should have went to Boris's instead of Leno's place.
Exactly.
So I just kind of would hang out in the garage a little bit and talk to Jay, and you were surprised that I knew who you were. You were surprised that I'd recognized you. But I thought, man, this guy's got his bikes, he's got his Roadmaster, he's got his garage,
yeah,
he's on a great schedule. And I thought, I got to figure out a way to get from spreading the stucco to spreading the mirth like the great Jay Leno.
There you go.
From that point on, I was just like,
well, you've done well. You've done well.
Well, you know, I don't know what your relationship is with, this will be a good question for you, Jay. I love cars, as you know. Mm. You love cars. And, you know, the cars we love aren't cheap or free, and someone's got to pay for this. And I want the same thing you wanted. I wanted mechanics. I wanted to fabricate things. I wanted to restore things, you know. Right. And I made a pretty simple decision, which is as long as I'm spreading the stucco up on the scaffolding, it's going to be difficult to do a lot of things I want to do in terms of my passion for cars, you know. And I sort of made a kind of nuts and bolts, like, you know, I'm going to start working on comedy because I think there's a better payday there. And then I can, you know, I'm going to pack everything up and go to Laguna Seca in 2 months and do a vintage race. And I couldn't afford to do that if I was a carpenter.
Right.
So a lot of it was sort of practical and a little less art. You know what I mean?
Well, to me, I thought it was a great job. It was a good job.
Right.
You know,
but a job, you're emphasizing.
Yeah, and that's a mistake most people make. They think it's just fun. I remember once I hosted Saturday Night Live, and my friends came down, and after you host, they have the, you know, the rap party. Oh, okay, great. Then they come to the Tonight Show one Monday, you know, they're all in the audience, and afterwards I go to my office, and they all come up, hey, where's the rap party? I go, I do this every day. We don't have a rap party. Guys, I'm going back to work now. I got to write the monologue for tomorrow. I can't go out. Oh, you're not going to go out? Have drinks? No, I got to work in tomorrow, the next day. You do this every day. And people forget that it's show business. They forget the business aspect of it. They just go for the show, and that's it, you know?
I was always kind of surprised, if you've been on the set or been a guest on a variety of different talk shows, late night as well as daytime and whatever, you'll notice that there's a kind of that each set has a personality. I don't mean the set. I just mean the people, how it works. And Jay's set was very interesting. The thing I took note of on your set is that we'd be doing some run through or rehearsal or something, and your head writer or someone in that capacity would like come up to you and go, hey, Jay, that thing's not working, or you're doing this wrong, or you're doing it out of order. And I was watching it going, that doesn't take place on most of these kind of sets where somebody comes up and says you're not doing it right.
I'm a huge believer in low self-esteem. The only people with high self-esteem are criminals and actors, because they think this, if it wasn't for that, I would be a huge success. I mean, I'm dyslexic, and my mom would always tell me when I was a kid, you're going to have to work twice as hard as the other kids to get the same thing. And I always thought, well, that seemed fair. I'll just work twice as hard, and if I can get the same thing just by doing that, okay, that's fine. And to me, when I got the Tonight Show, I figured, let me hire these people. They know what they're doing. I'm good at the joke part. I'm not really good at the directing or whatever, so I'll hire good people and listen to them. And that was my thing on the Tonight Show, that anybody could stop the train. Anybody could pull the whistle, stop the train, if there's something they don't like or something they thought was wrong. And sometimes it makes it a little laborious, but everybody feels invested in the show. I mean, we had no turnover in 22 years. We had the same people all the way, you know. And the funny part was, everybody I hired, most had never worked in television before, and most were single. So they all wound up marrying each other. And we had 64 kids born.
Wow.
In 22 years. With staff members on the show, because everybody was just, it was just fun. I mean, I hate places that say, we're family here. Any store that says we're family, that means they don't want to pay you any money because they think you're family. So I never used that term. But it was kind of like that a little bit. I mean, everybody got along fine. You know, when you work on the show, like when I hired writers, I hired them for a year. I didn't hire them for 13 and dump them, because it takes sometimes 20 weeks to find my voice with that writer. Just to, you know, I would tell people, just write everything. And when I hired people, we hired based on material. Submit me material with no name on it. And I would read it and I go, let's hire this person. And one turned out to be a rabbi, middle-aged. The other turned out to be somebody with severe cerebral palsy who couldn't even leave his apartment.
Wow.
But wrote good jokes.
Wow.
But if that person had come in sort of, you know, in that, you know, that convoluted kind of wheelchair that has, I'm not being disrespectful here, just, you know, and then somebody get them up the stairs and their head is looking one way, and, you know, but he wrote great jokes. And that worked pretty well. That worked pretty well. I never hired anybody that had an agent. I just said, submit me jokes. You know, I was standing at Polo Loco, and this guy behind me, Sal Jay Leno, hi, I'm so-and-so. I just graduated college. Where'd you get a degree? And I sound engineering. I hope to be a sound engineer. I said, oh, you any good? He goes, yeah, I'm good. I said, come to the Tonight Show tomorrow. He came by, and I hired him. He stayed there 23 years. That was Pat, yeah.
Had 26 kids.
With
11 interns.
Yeah, so it was fun. It was a fun place to work. I really enjoyed it. It was a great time. You know, a lot of ups and downs, but that's okay. That's okay. It was exciting.
Low self-esteem. This is interesting to me. I always tell people I don't have low self-esteem. I just have no self-esteem. I don't really think about.
Okay, let's go with no self-esteem. I'll take that. I mean,
it's
I just don't assume that I'm the smartest person in the room.
But the self-esteem to me is neither here nor there. That's the way I look at it. Like, I don't look at myself as low. Like, oh, you're so bad or you're dumb or you're whatever. There's stuff I'm good at and there's stuff I'm not good at, but that's not. I'm not constantly evaluating my self-esteem. I think the self-esteem
I think more like I'm a mutt and a purebred thing here. Okay. And I try to use these every one of those both sides of the coin there at the same time. You're probably right. Rather than low self-esteem. Low self-esteem just sounds funnier because, like I say, when you assume you're not the smartest person in the room, you don't speak first. You let other people speak and hear what they have to say. Okay. Oh man, that's better than what I had. Okay. All right. I'll go with that. You know, as opposed to.
Well, also you're the person who's telling the joke, so ultimately it's going to be you'll get the credit for the joke. So
exactly.
Use the best joke in the room.
Right.
So, I often think about I think about your collection. I think about how much you love cars. The thing that's interesting about you and vehicles and cars is, pardon the pun, most people pick a lane. You know, you talk to those guys all the time or they tell you they're a car nut and then they tell you they're a Mopar guy.
Right.
And then if you bring up a BMW M1, they go, what? I don't know what that one is.
Yo, I have a friend who's right. I got a friend who's a Mopar guy. He can tell you, that was built on a Thursday.
Right.
I remember Larry was working the undercoating that day, right. And this is why you have this smear on the guy. And he came to my garage and he goes, Duesenberg, what's that, German?
Right.
No, it's American. You know, Duesenberg? I mean, I've heard it. I thought it was German. No, it's an American built. Really? I mean, it's the American car. And he was a Mopar guy. That's all he did.
Right. And I cannot find a real lane for you in terms of brands. I think you appreciate the mechanics, the mechanicals.
I'm bi-Carl. I like all kinds of cars.
Individually.
Yeah.
And
I like noble failures. I like cars that were ahead of their time, in their time. Cars that were built too good, they couldn't possibly make a profit. Because I was driving a car just today called the Will St. Clair. Now, Will St. Clair, he was Harold Wills was his name. He was Henry Ford's metallurgist. He was Ford's first employee.
Really?
He designed the planetary transmission. He didn't invent vanadium steel, but was responsible for it because he was a metallurgist. He designed the Ford logo, the blue oval. Those
really?
Things today.
Yeah.
He was Henry Ford's first, if not very first, employee. And Ford split everything with them 50-50.
Wow.
And Ford being somewhat cantankerous, they had a falling out. And he took his, would be equivalent of $20 million in stock and started the Will St. Clair car. It was overhead cam, 1920. Overhead cam, V8, no fan belt, everything driven internally, fan driven internally.
It's all chain driven or gear driven?
No, gear driven. No,
wow.
Gear driven.
Ooh.
Gear driven cams.
Wow.
Based on the Hispano Suiza aero engine.
I mean, that's very intricate.
I mean, it's the most. And Henry Ford, they were still friends. Henry Ford came out to take a look at it and said, it's too complicated. Nobody can fix it. And nobody wants to go 70 miles an hour. And every car was a prototype. He always kept trying to improve it and make it.
What was the displacement?
265 cubic inch, 67 horsepower. I'll show you. It's one of the most beautiful motors you've ever seen. But he built about 12 or 14,000 of them. But ultimately, he went under because it was supposed to be a $2,000 car, turned out to be a $3,000 car when a Ford Model T was $260.
Right.
Henry Ford's genius was he built exactly what people needed and not 1 cent more.
You know? Right. He was kind of McDonald's versus foodie chefy.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
I'm gonna serve crepes on a taco truck.
Good food at sensible prices. Thank you. Yeah.
Right. And so for you, not being a Mopar guy or a Porsche or Ferrari guy, just sort of going, I'm looking for the most uniquely or ambitiously engineered car with, I think, you probably like the story as well.
Yeah, like I bought a Carrera GT. That was my first Porsche. But I bought the clutch
year?
First.
Sorry.
2004. I bought the clutch because it had that 6-inch carbon fiber clutch. So I called Porsche and I said, can I get one just to look at it? And I was so impressed with the clutch, I bought the car. And I thought, oh, I just found it fascinating that you could put that much power through a little 6-inch clutch.
Yeah.
And it was just a beautifully engineered thing.
The Carrera GT, Paul Walker famously died with one
right.
of his partner. Also, somebody else died in one of those cars at Fontana, mm-hmm. I believe, at some point.
Yeah.
I don't know. And you went around Daytona or Talladega? I'm sorry.
Talladega.
Talladega, 200 miles an hour?
No, 190.
190, one of those.
100 laps, 190.
One of those cars.
Right.
Probably more dangerous than you'd thought at the
time.
Boy,
well, you know what's really interesting? Now, this is 2004, and I'm driving that car going 190, and every time we get to the corner, you feel it start to just move up the wall a little bit. It's like, mm-hmm.
Right, the bank.
Know, and the
bank.
Car, and it's just walking around. Now, we had Norbert Singer. He's the famous suspension guy from Porsche. He came through and went through the car and did everything. Then what? 15 years later, I'm in Detroit with the ZR1 Corvette with Juchner, Taz Juchner, the head engineer for mm-hmm. for Corvette. Mm-hmm. And I call him up and I say, can we take it to 200 miles an hour? He said, sure. Okay. So we go to the proving ground in Michigan. Oh, who's this again?
Okay. Tell him you're doing a podcast.
I'm doing the middle of a podcast. I'll call right back. And I'm with Taz Juchner. So I said, are you a chief engineer for Corvette? Yeah, we get in the car. I said, before we go, tell me the first time you went 200 in a Corvette. He said, well, I never have. I said, what do you mean you never have? He said, I haven't. I've never been that fast in a Corvette. I said, so the first time you're going over 200 miles an hour is with a comedian who's never been on the track in a car you designed but have never taken to. He said, I guess so. I said, let's go do that. Okay. So we get on the track. Now we're averaging about, I think we averaged 204, but we hit 212 and just kept, we went 50 miles at 204 miles an hour
wow.
average. Rock steady, didn't move.
Really?
Just unbelievable.
A
just
far cry from the
and this is a Corvette,
GT.
not a $500,000.
Right.
But it,
right.
it shows you how far aerodynamics and suspension have come in just 15 years.
I think famously, and you guys can look this up if you want. I'm just showing off in front of Jay. But Mark Donohue, who drove the 917 Porsche.
Right. I was with his son.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. He was with me.
Can-Am car went yeah. out to Talladega to set the speed record in that car.
Yeah.
In that 917. Then he, I think, died during practice or something.
I think
very
you're right.
shortly
I think you're right.
thereafter. But let's talk about, you don't have any kids.
No.
You have all these cars. At some
and
point.
Motorcycles.
And tons of motorcycles. At some point, your facility is going to have to become a museum.
Not my problem.
But you must have some thoughts about it.
Not really. No, not my problem. I don't know. Whatever happens, happens. You know, people make all these plans like they're going to be looking down to see what happens to their stuff after they die.
No, I get it. But you must be approached by the Peterson Museum or somebody who says, like, hey,
no,
what are we going to do with
really.
These cars?
You know, I remember I get a lot of calls from wives whose husbands have died and I'm interested in purchasing, you know. And this all seems so ghoulish. And this woman called me, and her husband had a speedster Porsche, like a 58. And she says, she's at the funeral. They are lowering the casket into the ground. She feels a tug on her shoulder. And the guy goes, look, I know this isn't probably a very good time, but, you know, if you've given any thought about selling them.
It's like, funny.
The guy's not even in the ground.
That's
hilarious.
That's
she goes, it's not. It's not a good time. Oh, it's not? Oh, okay. You know, and they're like, really, the guy doesn't have a clue.
So there's nothing on paper saying this is where these cars are going.
Maybe I'll give it some thought now. Honey, Adam said we should do something about the cars.
It seems, I don't know. I it often crosses my mind. I don't want to sound ghoulish either, but I just think.
But there's something that you want. Which one is it? Which one is it?
I've never thought in those terms, but. Now that you mentioned it, the McLaren F1.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just car, I just took a shining to.
That's the greatest.
Not for nothing.
Investment I ever. People thought I was out of my mind when I bought that car.
What'd you pay for it?
Well, what happened was I'd been reading about them, and they had been out of production for like 5 years.
Is that, 93, 94?
No, this is
the F1.
Mine is the 94. I got it 98.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay, so I can't really find one. So I call McLaren. I speak to Harold Dermott. Harold and Jay Leno. Oh, Miss Leno, yes, I said, I'm interested. I mean, we have one here. We have black McLaren here, car number 15. It's for sale now. I said, how much is it? He goes, $800,000. I said, well, that's just about what it costs new, isn't it? He goes, well, true, but we think they're going to go up in value. I said, well, $800, that's a lot. I said, you want to think about it? I said, yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll call you back in 2 weeks. If it's not sold, I'll buy it. So in the 2 weeks, I'm going, oh, I hope they sell it. I'm an idiot I am to buy this stupid thing.
This is 1998.
Right.
Yeah, $800. Yeah. You get a nice big house in the hills.
Yeah, exactly.
For $800,000 in 1998.
So I said, okay. So
a big house.
So the 2 weeks go by, I call them, Harold Jenner. Hello, Jay. Yeah. Listen, about the car. He goes, yes, we got an inquiry today, a query. We got a query on the car today. I'm thinking, oh, really? The day I called, they got a query on the car. Right. I said, well, should I call the fellow back? I'll take it. I'll take it. All right. Okay. We'd like you to come for fitting. We set the seat to you and blah, blah. You know, all the typically English sort of nonsense.
Sit in the middle of that car.
Yeah, sit in the middle. Right. And so I went over and I bought it. And it was funny because now it's a used car.
Right.
And there was a luxury tax of 5%. On all cars over $30,000 in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I bring it in, and the custom guy, it comes in the port in the East Coast near Boston because I had to get it certified by a guy who would certify it.
Yeah.
And he says, import tax is this, and it's $50,000 for the luxury car tax. I said, but it doesn't apply to used cars. And the guy says to me, no used car costs $800,000. I go, well, it's a 94. Here's all the, I have my lawyer send the information. He goes, I don't care. He said, now we can keep it here in the dock for 6 months or a year until you get all your thing, or you could pay $50,000 and get it out tomorrow. All right. So then I pay the $50,000.
Wow.
What am I going to do?
Yeah, I know.
Okay. So that's what I do. So then I get here. And of course, the last offer I got for it was $17.5 million. Yeah. One went for 20, and then one just sold privately for 24.
And that's why when I stated the one car I wanted, as much as I like the story about the guy who built the one, put the Indian engine in it,
right,
his son drove it.
Bob
from
Shotwell, yeah,
drove it from Seattle to New York.
No, he drove it from.
Oh yeah, that's cute.
Yeah.
But I'll take the McLaren.
Right.
What I'm saying. Exactly. So if we could just get a post-it and put my name on it, just kind of stick it to the fender. Did the one that sold privately for $24 million, is that the same? I know there's different versions of them every once in a while, like a lightweight or a track or something.
Well, there's no track version. They're all road cars. They never built
but
a race car.
Something, in fact, R model or
it
something.
It was the last car you could drive to Le Mans, win the race, and drive home.
Wow.
It was a street car.
So the $24 million one was the same one as your car?
Well, with less horsepower.
With less horsepower.
Yeah, because they felt it had too much of an unfair advantage. So they cut about 60 or 70 horsepower from it.
Oh, the sanctioning body.
Right, the sanctioning
when
body.
They,
yeah,
you so, mean when they homologated it.
When they homologated it, yeah. So it came from the factory at 627 horsepower. The one that won Le Mans probably had 550.
Wow. All right, let me hit JB Weld here. DIY projects. Yeah, well, you're talking to Mr. Leno, Mr. Carolla, and we do a lot of this stuff. You want to use the best. You don't want to use ordinary glue. Ordinary glue, well, it's got the word ordinary in it. You want something better. You want a strong choice. You want JB Weld. We're proud to have him as a sponsor. They're great. I know these guys. I saw them at SEMA. Saw their booth over at SEMA where I see Jay every year.
I've used that. It's great.
I walked over there and introduced myself, struck up a conversation with the owner. And I said, well, come on as a sponsor. And next thing you know, I got a box of JB Weld and a hat. And here we are. JB Weld. Put it in your toolbox. Put it in your kitchen drawer. It's good for metal, wood, plastic, and whatever you're using it on. I have it at the shop. I have it in my garage. Don't glue it. JB Weld it. It's available at jbweld.com. Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, O'Reilly, Walmart, Amazon, Michaels, and more.
You know,
it's JB Weld. Yeah.
You remind me of, there used to be a guy named Bob Braun who did a TV show. He was like the Mike Douglas of the Midwest. Mm. He did Ohio and like the tri-state area. And he would do that. He would be talking to you and he would slip into the, he would say like, Jay, what'd you have for lunch today? You know, I had a hamburger. Jay had a con wiener. You know, con wiener, the wiener the world's waited. You know, the con wiener. And I go, what? And I realize, oh, he would just slip into the commercial, right into it. Like you're talking to me and you're like, what, like J.B. Weld? What J.B. Weld? What? I mean, that's like the funniest thing.
It's a little different rhythm than the old Tonight Show and what where we were. I like that guys like you. And to me, to some degree, are guys like Phil Rosenthal. Phil Rosenthal likes traveling and he likes food. So he made a show where he travels around and eats food. Jay
right.
likes meeting people and cars. So he made a show where he gets to meet people and drive cars.
Well, see, now, maybe this is why I like cars and mechanical. It might be the same. We are a business that's very subjective. Every day I read, some people like me. Some people think I suck. That's fine. And they're both correct because if I don't make you laugh, then in your eyes, I suck. But when something's broken and it's now running, no one can say it's not running.
Right.
You can't say, no, it's not. You hear it? Well, fine. You know, put your hand on the exhaust pipe if you don't think it's running. You know, I mean, and that's what's fun about it because when you work in the garage, you put something together. I mean, I feel the greatest sense of elation when I fix something. I was driving my AC Cobra the other day and the steering column just dropped down on me. And I went, what is this?
I thought your 427?
No, I got a 64 289. And I went,
excuse me.
I went, oh, what am I going to do?
I'll take that car, by the way, too. Go ahead.
But I thought the steering box, and I got underneath it, and I realized, oh, there's just a 916th bolt here. It's on a slide. Mm-hmm. I just tightened it up, and I went, ah, and then I went for another 100-mile drive just because I felt like I had done something with my day. I'd taken something that was broken. And I fixed it, and now it works. I mean, a simple fix, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It took a while to figure out what it was, but that's okay. And that's why I enjoy the mechanical nature of things, because when you fix something that's broken, you've done something.
No, and you're right. It's beyond reproach. So in a world where everyone has an opinion and you have to argue with everybody
right.
about everything and, oh, you think you're an expert. You know, Dr. Drew's greatest lament is that everyone argues with him. And he has 30 years of medical training. And
right.
He has people telling him his business all the time because they just went to WebMD and blah, blah, blah. And you know, as a comedian, sure, that guy's funny. That guy's not funny. That guy's
right.
offensive.
Right.
That guy's not offensive. I said, the only thing I miss really about being a carpenter is nobody ever would come up and go, oh, that's the way you do a hinge mortise. I do it this way, or give me that, or I'll handle that, or I'll put that base shoe up. Like, they couldn't do it. They didn't know how
right,
to do it, and
right.
they'd leave you alone.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I had a guy in the Tonight Show. I'm sorry. I can't remember his name. He's the first blind man ever to climb Everest. And he's like one of these terrific motivational speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets so angry because he said he will go. He'll talk about the problem of being blind when climbing Everest, you know, you've got to feel everything. You can't look and see a ledge. You've got to touch. You can't see, you know.
Eric Weinemeyer.
Yeah.
Eric Weinemeyer.
I mean, a sighted person could see, oh, you're going on a ledge that eventually
right.
disappears. So go off to this ledge. And he would give his whole talk. And, you know, the thing, overcoming, you know, to business people, overcoming adversity and not being able to breathe and you can't see. Is it night? Mm-hmm. Is it day? He said, inevitably, someone would come up to him and go, you know, I was going to climb Everest last summer, but then, you know, my kids are in this soccer thing and I needed to get involved. But, you know, I was thinking of doing it. And
he says, it's all he could do, just from like taking his cane, just whacking the guy in the face. You know, just because he trained for this. The first blind person to climb, unassisted. I mean, he had people with him, but not, you know, it just, and people just took it like, yeah, I was going to do that too.
Yeah.
And I was going to think of trying that. And I'm sure you hear this all the time. You know, I was going to do comedy, but then, you know, I decided maybe insurance sales was more for me. But, well, I'm sure you would have been a huge success if you pursued it, you know.
Well, you also get a lot of like, well, you're lucky you met Kimmel when you did. It's like, well, Kimmel wasn't doing anything when I met him, you know.
Funny,
he wasn't running his own late night show. Funny. They love to minimize that accomplishment, because I think it just makes it easier for them to sort of accept their lot in life. Now, how much mechanical bleeds into the comic or the material, not the material specifically, but the assembly of the material? Like how much of your brain is very sort of linear. When you work on things, you have to have an order, sort of you have to do things in the right order. You have to be kind of methodical about it. You know, I know you get out and work out every week at Hermosa, and your mechanic. I've seen your stand up; it's very funny, but it has a lot of precision.
There's a book you would love called Precision by Simon Winchester. It's one of the greatest books. You would love this book because it is all about precision, starting with steam engines of the 1700s, right up into the modern iPhone, and. As a comic, you know, I always try to me, the real essence of comedy is economy of words. Use the fewest amount of words will get you the biggest possible laugh. The quicker you get to the joke, the funnier it is. Like, you never want to repeat a word in a sentence twice. It's like,
right.
River, that a river. Now, you said river twice. Make it the body of water in one and river in the other. And I always try to do that. Sometimes when you talk to civilians who want to be comedians, they talk like this. So I goes to him, right? And like this guy, like he goes to me when I go back to him. I go, what do you mean go? You mean talk to him?
Right.
It's just the most annoying. It's like fingernails on a blackboard. You know, it's just the most annoying thing ever.
So the precision that you enjoy so much in the mechanical world, I would say it's safe to say that that has been brought to your stand-up as well.
So.
Maybe it's unbeknownst to you. Maybe it's just a way of thinking. Maybe it's that kind of
Try to use the fewest amount of words. I was trying to I had a joke. Tell me if this is funny. You know, with all this, it's very competitive out there now in the marketplace with this pandemic thing. Like the 99-cent store is now accusing the dollar store of price gouging.
Right, funny. I saw you do it on Mar.
Oh, you saw? I love that joke. Yeah,
it's a great joke.
Yeah, yeah.
And you told a bunch of good jokes on that.
Sometimes it's one just
a week before last.
Just
on
to
Mar.
Do silly jokes. You know, one of my favorite ones is because you don't really see where it's going. That's kind of the fun part. I said, I this is true. I'm doing a gig in Alaska. So I go up to Alaska. It's February. Okay, the sun comes up at 11:30 in the morning and goes down again at 1:30 in the afternoon. It is like 50 degrees below zero. Yet when I walked into the thrifty drugstore, the ice cream was still soft. Why is why is that? I don't understand why that is. I mean, I just like that joke.
Yeah, it's a good joke.
I like well-fabricated jokes. I like this one. Like, there was a story about a kid in China that had the vestiges of a third eye. Literally, it wasn't an actual eye, but it had the vestiges of a third eye in the center of his forehead. And today, lens crafters said they can make him glasses in about an hour and a half. I mean, I just like that joke.
You love jokes. I don't know. I'm trying to think of like how you would. Everyone has to describe this style now to everyone. You know, he's a storyteller. He's a comedian.
I like
comedian.
To tell stories. I mean, stories are what I really enjoy the most. You know, I told a story the other day when I was doing one of my Jay Leno's Garage things. I was driving my 57 Chrysler Imperial. And I talked about this guy. My dad had a friend named Mario the Carpenter. And Mario had a 59 Oldsmobile convertible. you know, with like silver, red leather interior. And Mario was the classic 50s Italian guy from New York with the jet black hair, the big muscles. He had the Marlboros rolled up in the sleeves. And my mother, who was from Scotland and was the most conservative person you could imagine, I heard her once say to one of her girlfriends, "Oh, that Mario, you know, whenever he comes by, the women swoon, you know." And I go, "Oh." So one day we always had Sunday dinner. We ate dinner at 1:30 to 2 o'clock, and there was always a big dinner.
That was Sunday dinner.
And my dad invited Mario the carpenter. So Mario comes in, and he's still got the T-shirt on, even at dinner with the Marlboros, and he sits down. So I look at Mario, and I look at my mom. I look at the other women at the table. I look at Mario, and I look at mom. And my mother goes, what are you doing? I said, "Well, Mom, you said the women all swoon whenever Mario comes in. I don't see anybody swoon." My mother, "Oh!" Just ran out, locked herself in the bathroom. Meanwhile, Mario's like, "He's got the Marlboro. He's smoking like the cockiest guy in the world." You know, it's just funny. It's just funny. You know, I used to love those things when I was a kid. You know, when I was I used to like the Sunday dinners because I got to sit with the adults, you know. And one day we're having a Sunday. And when you're a kid, I'm like seven, you know. And I had my Uncle Louie, who was a bachelor, who had a lot of women, you know. My mother said, "Now, Louie, where's that lovely Louise? You're not seeing her anymore. How come?" And my Uncle Lou goes, "She was frigid." And my mother just, I see her lips tighten. You just throw him a look, you know. And Lou realized, "Oh, the kid's at the table." And look, and we see my dad, like, he's looking away. And I go, "Frigid, what does it mean?" Okay, so I pass this all, whatever, so fine. So then the next day I go to the library, look up the word frigid. It says frozen as in a block of ice. Frigid. Okay. Well, next Sunday we have Sunday dinner. Lou's sitting there, and I think this is, you know, I'm a kid. And I say, "Lou, I'm sorry to hear about Louise passing away." My mother goes, "What are you talking about? What?" "Well, I guess she froze to death in a block of ice or something." And my uncle goes, "What are you talking about?" "Well, last week you said she was frigid." Same thing. My dad falls out of the chair. Louise laughed. That was the beginning. That was the inception of the children's table. From that point on,
that's when they invented it.
The card table was off to the side. I ate dinner with the other kids off to the side. That was the last time we ate at the grown up table. I just love those kind of stories. They just make me laugh, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking about the first joke I could ever remember telling was that same around the dinner table joke. Yours was a from the mouth of babes kind of joke. Mine was sort of intentional, which is my family's kind of busted up and we didn't have the Sunday dinners, but my grandparents lived nearby, and my grandfather, my step grandfather's Hungarian, and he would cook goulash and other Hungarian food, which I loved. And so we'd go to their house for dinner. And I said to my grandfather, goulash. And I said to him, what's goulash mean? Like, what's a translation of goulash? And he said, he thought about it. He said, it's cowboy. It's a cowboy stew. It's like it means cowboy stew, they would call it.
Right.
And I said, "Oh, so when you're a kid, you play goulash and Indians?" And it's like, you know, for a 7.5-year-old.
Not bad, yeah.
It wasn't bad. You could tell the little gears were turning in the comedy department.
Right.
And I guess that's kind of how I always thought. I got kind of pulled into the blue-collar world and spent too much time there.
Do you find that – I found that every funny thing I ever said always made a little indentation in my mind.
Well,
I remember being no more than 4 or 5, and my mother took me everywhere because we couldn't afford a babysitter. And we went to my Aunt Edie's – like the women would meet for wine, you know, all the moms and the aunts and everything. And my mom would bring me along. I remember sitting there and all the women, ooh, you know, like third glass of wine. And my mom said, I put my hand up. I said, and this seemed like a perfectly legitimate question. I said, "How come women have humps like camels?" "Woohoo! Listen to that! Woo, Kathy, that boy! Oh, my God! Woo!" Just kind of, what did I say? Stop with that. What did I say? I didn't understand what I said. But I remember, I can see the room. I can see the wallpaper. I can remember all the people there.
Right.
You know, it's funny. I mean, the first joke I ever told that got a laugh, I was at Mrs. Allen's class in the 4th grade, and she was talking about Robin Hood.
About what?
Robin Hood.
Robin Hood.
And she learned about Robin. She said the sheriff of of Nottingham was very cruel. He would often boil Robin's men in oil. And I put my hand up and I said, "Do you know what? Do you know why he did that to Tuck?" And she said, "No, why?" I said, "Because he was a friar." Okay, right. And she goes, "That's not funny." But I could, I could see, like she's kind of laughed, you know. So then we class, we go, bell rings, we go to our next class, and after the next class, one of the teachers said, "Hey, Leno, come over here. What was she said? You said something about a friar in class. What was that?" I said, "Oh, friar." She told my joke in the teacher's lounge.
Wow, the ultimate tip of the cap.
Oh, yeah, that was that. Yeah, it was like, ooh. So I always remember that. That got a big laugh.
So for you, everyone always wants to know where it comes from, but my parents weren't particularly funny. I don't know if
My parents were hilarious.
They
my
were. Dad Do you was, got it from them?
My dad was loud, a prize fighter, and Italian. My mom was quiet, demure, Scotch woman, and they were the funniest people. They just, as a kid, to watch the Scotch side, when we would go to my Aunt Nettie's house, that was my mother's side, "Would you like a scone, Jamie?" And she'd give me this stale biscuit, and she'd, "Would you like a Coca-Cola?" And she kept Coca-Cola in the cupboard because you don't need to refrigerate it, Jamie. It tastes the same. It's in a can. It doesn't matter whether it's warm or cold. It tastes the same. And she'd pour this Coke and all the fizz would come out and I'd have the stale biscuit. And then we would go to my Aunt Edie's house and it would be meatballs and lasagna and spaghetti. And then whenever the Italians would come, they'd pull me and say, "Jamie, the Italian people waste food, Jamie. Look, there's 25 meatballs here, Jamie. There's only 4 people. Who's going to eat all those meatballs? It's a terrible thing the way they waste food, the Italian people." And, and then my Uncle Jay come over here and he'd slip me $5. "Don't listen to those Scotch people. They're cheap bastards." And it was just funny. It was just because I was always – everybody was vying for my affection and vying for my attention or was trying to win me over, So I had a wonderful childhood. It was an ethnic childhood in that sense that we were Italian and my mother was Scotch and the Jewish family, the Henrys, lived across the street. And it was – everybody had their own – I was like a Shabbos guy. My job was to go turn off the lights for the Jewish people on the Sabbath and do other – so, it was just fun. I enjoyed it. My parents were very funny people that way. They just – embarrassing my mother was my mother hated to have attention drawn to herself, and she'd always say, "When you get to school, stay quiet. Don't put your hand up. Don't follow. No, tell me you're Angelino's boy. You don't listen to your mother. You say, Angelino's my father," So I would always be, so there was always something on both sides, Like when I was a little kid, we would go to the market and I would run away. And then I'd run up to the manager and go, "Could you page Mrs. Catherine Leno? That's my mom." "What, Catherine Leno?" My mother's so embarrassed to hear her name in the supermarket. She would run up and grab me, and just, "What are you doing? Stop."
But it's interesting because you kind of have a dichotomy where you like being up on stage. You like people. You like interacting with people. And then there's a kind of quiet work on the car alone, kind of a solitude, go out to the garage on a weekday. And so maybe you have both that sort of coursing through your veins.
Oh, yeah. Yes, because I think, when I got the Tonight Show, it was originally the Tonight Show starring Jay Leno. And my mother, "Starring Jay Leno. Oh, listen, it's the big shot. Starring Jay Leno. Put your name all over things. It's a kind of a show-offy thing to do. Don't you think, Jamie?" I said, "Mama, that's just the way they do it. Starring Jay Leno. He's a big star." But my mother couldn't get past it. So I just changed it to Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Just to placate my mother because, starring Jay Leno. Mr. Who's Who. Listen to him now. He's Mr. Big Shot. Starring Jay Leno. Yeah, hilarious. My mother couldn't get past that.
Well, maybe she's gave you the now what I've dubbed the no self-esteem, and the no self-esteem frees you up to get into a Porsche GT and try to set a speed record at Talladega.
Well, first of all, it's one of those phony speed. It's one of those records they make up. Nobody has gone 190 miles an hour for 100 miles in a Porsche Carrera GT. So it's not like I beat some professional race car driver. It's just a record.
No, I get it, but I've been around. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today is because I watch Jay Leno's Garage, and I see they go, "We're going to go up in a fire helicopter." And so the guy goes, oh, get on. It's a Chinook or whatever. You climb into the fire helicopter. Next thing you know, the guy's just taken off. He drops a snorkel down over the swimming pool, picks up the water. Now he's banking hard and you're flopping around back there. Or you jump in the Hemi under glass or you jump in the race car with me at the race in Fontana. And I just think most people wouldn't just jump into those things.
Well, that's what's fun. That's the fun part.
Fun for you, but scary for others with higher self-esteem.
Well, sitting down and being forced to do a math problem, that would be frightening.
Right.
Or having to spell. I can't spell. I'm just like,
how'd you do all the cue card work with the being dyslexic and
I memorized most stuff.
You memorized most of it.
Most of it, but I would have, you know, that's the next. That's why your teleprompter would always throw me because it moves. With a cue card, everything is on the card. So if I jumped ahead, I could go back. It's all in front of me, so I could.
Were you able to read out loud pretty well?
Oh, yeah. That was not a problem, no.
But it was the dyslexia kicked in with the writing and.
Yeah, or spelling or anything of that nature. Yeah.
So I was not dyslexic, but I didn't learn to read or write. And so I had a lot of trouble spelling. I still do reading.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I remember at the beginning, cue cards were scary to me because I could not read, and reading out loud, you know, in front of the class was scary enough, but in front of a few million people. And
my first 2 weeks of the Tonight Show were live.
Oh, live.
Live, because there was some kind of strike going on, so we had no cue cards. So we had to memorize a monologue, 14-minute monologue every day.
The first 2 weeks?
Yeah, the first 2 weeks, yeah.
So you get out of the gate. How long did they have guests after Carson, or did they have guests after Carson?
They didn't. You mean guest hosts? They didn't. It was just me.
Just went right from Carson to you.
You probably like that story. This is why I never took a job for the money. There were like a half a dozen people that were regular guest hosts. Joan was the permanent guest host. She had kind of dropped the ball there with
At the end of Carson's reign, he would once or twice a week someone would guest host? Or how would that?
Well, yeah, he was off 15 weeks a year.
Okay.
So they had all these guest hosts. Okay. And there was a manager who had as clients, like, of the six or seven guys, he had like five of them.
The guest house.
Yeah. And he called me up and he said, listen, we're going to go to Carson. We're asking $25,000 a show for each one of our guys. And they want you to join us. And I said, you know, I'm asking for $512 a show. He said, well, we can get $25,000 a show. We've gotten it in the past. I said, I know, but I get $512. I said, no, I'm going to keep it my $512. And then I'm named permanent guest host. Duh.
Right.
Johnny owned the show. He's paying for it out of his pocket. Why would he shell out $100,000 a week is what it would be to get four different guest hosts when you got this guy for $512? We all got about the same rating. So, and that's when I learned I never argue about money. What does it pay? Fine. Like I do Tim Allen's show now. I have no idea what it pays. I don't even look. I just go because I like Tim. It's a thrill to be on. We're going into our sixth season of me on the show. And it's fine. It's fine because I make my money. That helps me make money.
Yeah. No, I agree. Kevin Hinch, my friend, is the guy who runs that show. And I'm happy to see you on Tim's show. And Tim's on your show a lot.
Right.
But yeah, I agree. I don't think people understand that. By the way, even if it paid relatively well, it wouldn't make a difference in your life. It's not even worth.
No, it's not. I mean, it's but I mean, it's not the end all be all. I mean, to me, you don't want to outlive. You don't want to outperform your worth, if that makes any sense. If you're worth more, you'll get it. You know, I mean, that was. I never really asked for a raise on the Tonight Show, but I always got them.
One of the first conversations I ever had about money in radio is I was sitting in probably Trip Reeves' office at K-Rock, who was the general manager there, and he basically was saying, you're going to take over, do Loveline, and we're going to talk about how much to pay you. In his first offer, he said, I'll make you the highest paid part-time employee at K-Rock. And part-time employees are van drivers and phone operators. Guys make $7 an hour. You know, I was working 2 hours a night doing a show that was going to be widely syndicated and stuff. And I said to him, clear as a bell, I just said, Trip, I would do it for free. I'm not. I want to talk. I want the experience and everything. But as long as you're making money off it, then I want to get paid. But make no excuses. I would definitely do it for free. But if you're going to get rich, I'd like to get some of that. And that's sort of my approach. The lore is you never hammered one of your checks. You never cashed one of your Tonight Show checks, or they all just went to the bank.
Well,
or?
I banked them. I mean, I cashed them. They put them in the. No, I always wanted to live on the money I made as a comedian. I always wanted to be hungry. I never wanted to be one. I never wanted to be a guy. That's why this pandemic didn't bother me a whole lot. I've never taken a vacation. So when one is enforced on me, okay, I have no choice. Okay, fine.
Right.
And I never wanted to be a guy to go, how much should go to Cleveland? I'm not going there for that kind of money. I never wanted to be one of those performers because I lived on the street when I first came out. I used to sleep on the stairs behind the Comedy Store. What I used to do when I came to Hollywood, I would go to open houses on Sunday from like noon to four. I'd get to the open house at 3:30. I'd walk around and say, see you later. Thank you. And then I'd go sneak upstairs. I'd go into a bedroom. I'd shut the closet door and I'd sit there for maybe an hour until I heard the guy lock up.
Wow.
And then I'd live in the house for a day or two.
Really?
And one day I was sleeping on a house on Coldwater, which was belonged to one of the Beach Boys, apparently, was selling it. And I'm just sleeping in the bed and I hear the realtor. Now, here's the master bedroom. The two kids said, Mommy, there's somebody in the bed. Oh, I'm Rachel. What are you doing here? Get out. Get out. Well, can I get dressed, please? I got out and I ran out the back door. That was the only time I got caught. But that's what I used to do. I used to just go to open houses. And I never took anything. I never damaged the house. I always made the bed when I left. And I would just, because I had no place to live. You know?
Meaning you can have it all or have nothing. You've kind of done both of that.
I like having it all better than nothing. Yeah.
It's better, but everything is sort of gravy for you from where you come from or a younger version of yourself?
Yeah, I think so.
You never thought – I mean, no one ever thinks. Yeah, well, but you have how many square feet of warehouse do you have now?
It's 140,000.
140,000 square feet. I mean, obviously never anticipated.
No.
Never thought about it.
I never thought of – I remember – I was in New York, and I had no place to live, and I used to sleep in the alley at 44th and 9th right across from Dyke's Lumberyard. I used to go to that alley every night at midnight or 1, and I would just go to sleep, and it was a place where – and hookers would bring Johns in there. I would just hear the most horrible – I said, this is my life, really? This is awful. And my friend Louie had just bought a house for $38,000 in Massachusetts, and I went to visit him, and I went – man, I will never have anything like this. This is unbelievable. And he had a house and a garage, and he was married. And I thought, oh man, this is I'm just going to keep doing this and see what happens. And luckily, it panned out. But yeah, no, I never thought anything would come of it.
140,000 square feet. All right, I'm going to do a quick commercial.
Oh,
our last spot. Bet Online. When you were sleeping in that lumber yard back in the day, I bet you wish you had Bet Online. Nothing to bet on, right? Well, there's hundreds of events out there. You can props and things to wager on. You can try Vegas-style online poker and blackjack 24/7. Plus, you can bet on stock prices, the weather, Nathan's hot dog eating competition, NASCAR's back, which is pretty cool. Bet Online, our exclusive partner at Podcast One. You can sign up for a free account. Use the promo code Podcast One and get your sign-up bonus. So you visit betonline.ag. That's betonline.ag. Don't forget, use the promo code Podcast One and sign up for your bonus today. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts. That is Bet Online. Oh boy, Jay. God, it's been an hour and 15 minutes. I feel like I barely scratched the surface of this. I'm so thrilled that you have me on Jay Leno's Garage.
I love doing this show. Let's do some more. We'll have you on again. Be glad to.
Always, the one thing that always, I repeat this all the time that Jay said to me, and he probably doesn't even remember it, but I quote you all the time. I said to you, Jay, thanks for doing my show or the podcast or whatever it is, or being in the doc or whatever it is. And you went, it doesn't have to be that hard. It can be easy. It doesn't have to be that difficult. And I always think of you because in this town, you know, you call the guy and he wants to know why he didn't go through his publicist or whatever is. And it's like, it doesn't have to be that hard.
No, it isn't that hard at all. You know, that's the one thing I found that people think. The other thing is people have this idea it's this horrible cutthroat business. It's not. I mean, Steve Martin helped me tremendously. Harvey Korman, they came in to saw me. They told Carson about me. When I got fairly well known, I told Carson about Ellen DeGeneres. You got to come in and see this girl. She's really funny. I mean, comics like to help other comics. I always tell comedians, you will always get more work from the other comedians that you're starting out with than you'll ever get from an agent at the beginning. And it's true. I don't find it to be that way. And I don't find it that hard. Like to me on The Tonight Show, people would say, my guest will come, but he has to leave after. He can't stay on the couch. We've got places to go. Well, you really got to go? Yes, we have to go. All right. Okay. They come. Oh, goodbye. My guest has got to leave. Thank you. And then the show's over and they're still hanging around backstage.
Right.
And I go, what was that all about? Well, we think it looks better. What do you think it looks better? No. I mean, you're not on TV. You would have been on TV if you had stayed. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I agree. I feel the exact same way. I was thinking about Jay in Danger, and I reached out to him a couple days ago, and I said, you want to come on the show? And he said, yeah. And then so I called my guy, Mike, and I said, what's a good day? And he said, Wednesday. And I said, hey, Jay, how about Wednesday? And Jay said, I got to work Wednesday, but how about Monday or Tuesday? And I said, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
and here we are. I agree, and I feel the same way with Jay Leno's Garage. So whatever capacity you want me.
I'll tell you a great Rodney story.
Oh, Dangerfield.
Yeah, Rodney and I were good friends.
Sure.
I love Rodney. And I have Rodney on The Tonight Show, you know. I always, because I love doing that. Times are rough. Oh, a rough Jay, you know. And I love being his, I love being Rodney straight, man. It's my favorite thing. And one day he's on, and I'm watching him, and he's off. I can tell he's off. I don't think the audience didn't send you off, but he was sweating and his, you know, he does that, I tell you, you know, he grabbed his tie and he was grabbing his tie far lower than he usually, everything was off. So he's doing his routine, you know, and I said to Debbie, our producer, I said, call the paramedics. I think Roddy's having a stroke, you know. And she goes, really? I said, yeah, just call him. Okay. So Roddy comes over, sits down and he's fine. Then the show ends and Rodney is dressing.
So he's doing stand-up and he looks a little off.
A little off. Then he sits down. Hey, Jay, how are you? And he's, you know, he always pats his forehead like he's sweating, right. But he was really sweating. And anyways, okay, then he's on, then the singer, and okay. So, and then the show ends and Rodney's, then the paramedics show up and I go right this way. And I go, Rodney, the paramedics want to talk to you. Boy, what are you going to talk to me about? I think you had a stroke. He goes, what are you talking? So they give him he did have a stroke.
Okay. Wow.
So they take him to the hospital. Okay. So then we're sort of monitoring him after this point, had him on one or two other times. And then he had a terrible stroke, and he was in a coma. And I went to see him in the hospital. His wife, Joan, is the greatest. And she said, Jay, Rodney's in a coma. I think he can hear us, but he can't respond. So, hey, Rodney, how you doing? Nothing, you know. So she says, Jay, put your finger in Rodney's hand. So I put my finger in Rodney's hand. And she goes, Rodney, if you know it's Jay, squeeze his finger. So I feel a slight squeeze, and I go, Rodney, that's not my finger. You know? And Rodney does a, and he did a jump. He just did a tweak, you know. And I went, we made him laugh. And Joan got hysterical. Oh my God, Rodney made him laugh. But he moved,
right.
And then he died fairly soon after that. But it was just a great thing to make Rodney laugh one time.
The last person to make
him laugh. I don't know if I'm the last person.
I'm going to go with yes.
But what I mean,
a really funny nurse on that floor.
It was just, if you're going to be a comic, you know, and he was the greatest, you know, it was always about the jokes, no political opinion, no, it just, he comes out there, boom, boom, boom. And he was in his 80s and he was still pounding it out. So,
you know, what's so interesting about that story is the rhythm is so intricate, you know, and someone like you who'd been up on stage for so long and been exposed to so many comedians, even when the audience couldn't tell, you could tell from the peripheral, from the side almost, that the rhythm, like you weren't responding as a, you weren't listening to the
words.
Well,
to me, it's like listening to music. It's like listening to lyrics. Remember the first time I saw Seinfeld, he had a rhythm to his jokes. He talked about going to the amusement park and you come to the what do they call the bump 'em cars of the hopeless father and son team, you know. Right. And I just liked the way he phrased that. Letterman, too. Letterman was a great, great, still is, wordsmith. And he used to have this thing about local radio stations and self-importance. And I think I can't do it the way Dave does, but he said, we are diametrically opposed to the use of orphans as yardage markers on public golf courses. We feel this is a tough, you know, but the use of orphans as yardage markers, I just liked the way it, and that's when I introduced myself and I said, how do you phrase like that? Because I was a better performer than I was writer at the time. And Dave
at
was
the comedy store.
Yeah.
Back
and
when.
Dave was a much better writer than he was performer. And Dave could never understand how I could get up stage and just start talking.
Right.
And I didn't understand how he could have these intricately well-woven jokes. And we just got to be friends that way. And I think we each took a little bit from one another, you know?
Are you guys still friends? Do you converse?
Oh, yeah. I don't really converse. I mean, Dave is an interesting guy.
Yeah, you're not a converser.
No, but I think there's a mutual respect. And you know what it is? When you start out with people in this business, even if you have nothing else in common, there is a bond. Mm-hmm. Your brothers in comedy, whatever you want to call it, you have this bond. You know, it's like, you know, Kimmel and I had a kind of butted heads a while, but now I love the guy. I think he's great. And because you realize there's only 7 people in the world that do what you do, and they're the only ones that really understand it, you know? And so you can't really dislike him, you know. Even though we don't have a lot in common, we had comedy in common. And making Dave laugh was always my favorite thing to do. It still is. When I used to do his show, it was the greatest time in my life because Dave always liked laughing on the way to the joke more than the joke. Mm. You know, I would say, Dave, it's just out of the old Manson place, you know, where Charlie and up the Manson place, Way Leno. Yeah. We would get this sort of roll going, and it was really funny. It was really great, and I really enjoyed it. I would, you know, I knew Dave always got nervous before he went on, so whenever I would do his show, I'd stand backstage with like a huge meatball sub, you know, and as soon as I come, Dave, try this. He goes, how can you eat that? You're going on in. How can you eat before you go on? Don't you throw up? No, Dave, try this. It's delicious, you know. Yeah. And he would just, and then I would bring the meatball sandwich out and a meatball would roll out on his desk and he would get all annoyed. I mean, it was just a lot of fun.
I remember watching those early appearances with you on on Letterman show, and it was just so good. It was so organic. It was so funny, and it was, I guess, innocent or in a way that it's interesting when you travel through your career, and you know, I can picture Jimmy going out to Acapulco in Mexican food place because I had a 2-for-1 coupon, you know, and he's such a foodie now, but back then the Acapulco restaurant in Burbank was good eating, and the 2-for-1 coupon, right. And the conversations about like we can order one, but the second one's not going to be free if it's more than the first one, so you got to get the expensive one up front. Like these moments, thoughts, it almost seems like a different life in a weird way.
Yeah.
Well, Jay, I say we do this again because
tell me one.
There's a lot more here to get to. And Jay Leno's Garage, Wednesdays, 10 o'clock Eastern, CNBC.
Fact, it'll be on tonight. It's on, right? Is Wednesday?
So. Yes, this is Wednesday.
I think I got Matt LeBlanc tonight and Craig Ferguson, another great comic.
Yeah, and a good guy.
Very good guy.
Your mom would like him.
Yeah.
I think, is he Scottish or Irish?
He's Scottish. Oh, Scottish lad. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I kept thinking when your mom and the Scots were talking about being thrifty, there was a whole brand out here in, I think it was Ralph's. No, yeah, maybe it was Ralph's. Or maybe there was a whole brand called Scotch brand.
Right.
Scotch brand was the cheap generic version of the cleanser or the soap or the whatever, but it was,
Thrifty.
Yeah, the guy goes, and I'm thrifty too. And I was like, oh, Scott, I was, you know, watch these commercials when I was 10. I'm from North Holland. Like, I don't know what this means.
Yeah,
but
right.
Somehow.
Yeah, hilarious.
Hilarious for this. All right, we'll get into the paddy wagon next episode. Jay Leno's Garage, Wednesdays. And you can also watch the YouTube show, the YouTube channel, Jay Leno's Garage, as well. Shoot him a tweet, at Jay Leno. Good Sports is coming up until... Oh, I'm going to be in Zanies, Nashville, Tennessee, right? Coming up two shows.
Oh, you are? Wow, so you're back...
Tomorrow and Saturday,
yeah. Doing live shows again there?
They're doing live shows in a lot of parts of the country, and they're doing it about three-quarter capacity.
Right.
But I get to go out and get paid to do stand-up, so I'll be doing that.
But that's normal, right? Three-quarter capacity.
So until next time, Adam Carolla for Jay Leno saying mahalo.
Stay close. Adam Carolla, Dave Damashek, and Chael Sonnen return for Good Sports right after this.
Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. Welcome to a special edition of the Thursday installment of Good Sports. Oh, we're going to have some hot sports talk times two here. Nay, times three. Dave Damashek here. Adam Carolla over there. And Ace, we have a very special guest here on Good Sports.
MMA, great. Chael Sonnen with right about 50, just a couple fights under 50 mixed martial arts fights, and a funny and an all-around good guy as well. Good talk to Chael.
What's happening, guys? Nice to be here.
The podcast is You're Welcome with Chael Sonnen. New episodes every Wednesday and Friday on Podcast One, and the website is chaelsonnen.com. Let's talk UFC, because I feel like they... of all organizations, probably did the best job of staying down the least amount, being creative, sort of being fluid and getting back up and running, certainly quicker than any other professional sport I can think of, except for the aforementioned cornholing. So what fight's coming up and who do you like?
Cornholing is an underrated game, by the way, if you've never played, for all ages, and Adam, it's a lot of fun. Okay, I like all the fights coming up. Look, ultimately, we're going to have the heavyweight championship, Cormier versus Stipe. That's sometime this year. That's a true trilogy fight. They're fighting a third time, but they split the first two. I think it's very compelling. They both beat the heck out of one another on their respective nights, so now they got to do it a third and final time. That's probably the one I'm most looking forward to.
Who do you like? Sorry,
oh, go ahead. Ace. Sorry.
Who do you like in that fight?
You know, I think Cormier, with everything that he's saying, this is his last fight. I believe him. He is going out. I know he's a competitor at heart. He wants to go out on the right note, but he's going to need the right game plan. He's going to need to take Stipe down, hold him there. Maybe it's even a dull night and he wins, 10-9 with the judges. But I think that Cormier does have the skills to beat him, but I don't know if he has the discipline. If Stipe will take you out of your game, and if he does, Stipe will hurt you very bad. He's a good fighter, Adam. Stipe is a good fighter.
No. Yeah, go ahead, Chael.
Chael, I'm just curious about, because it's gotten a fair amount of news in the last couple of weeks or so, from John Oliver now with Fight Island.
Yes.
Tell what goes – I'm fascinated by the idea of it. I mean, it seems like other sports are kind of learning from it, too, because you hear about these, hyper-localized kind of places that they maybe have to play some of the playoff games and to keep up, whatever. But this Fight Island is the OG. What insight is there? Are there, like, hotels? How do you get there to watch this thing?
Okay, so my mind is in the same place your mind is in, okay? I don't know a lot about a private island. All I know is what my mind goes to. Like, I'm picturing the movie Castaway. There's nothing there. Are there hotels? Are there restaurants, to your point? Is there a hospital, for medical needs? What exactly does an island look like? And I don't think it's any of those things. I think this is a place, likely a resort-type atmosphere that does have buildings and shops and airports and these types of things. But Dana has been so quiet about this. And I got to tell you, I don't think that was ever his plan. I think he came out with this idea. The media has spun Fight Island into such a sensation. Not only am I curious, much like you, they're now selling merchandise that says Fight Island. Now Dana is purposely telling nobody anything because the speculation has been such a marketing success. So where's Fight Island? I don't know. Here, I'll tell you one thing. I have a teammate, Paige Van Zandt. She just got a contract sent to her yesterday to do a fight on Fight Island. And we were both so excited because that contract calls legally for a location. They have to put down the location. Guess what they put on a legally binding contract? Fight Island. We know nothing.
Wow.
We know nothing for that contract.
Paige Van Zandt, is she as attractive in person as she is on TV?
Yes, and Adam, you know what? Her personality is more beautiful than her physical essence, if you will. She is one of the best teammates I've ever had. On days she's hurt and she's been dealing with a very public injury to her arm, she's at practice every day on time, even if she can't get on the mat. She has a hello for everybody. She has a pat on the back as her teammates leave the room. Behind the scenes, I got to tell you, she is aces in my book.
Where is Cyborg? Is she just, she went from unbeatable to, she literally, Cyborg went from a woman who, oh, she could beat half the men in her weight division to, I guess she's done. What happened?
Okay, most intimidating woman in the history of time, as far as I've ever seen. She runs into Amanda Nunes. Turns out Amanda is a better fighter than Cyborg. Amanda takes the belt. Cyborg gets in a fight, public fight with Dana White, which nobody has ever won playing that hand, but she attempted to be the first. She didn't win. She ended up asking for a release. They granted it to her. She went to Bellator. She actually won the championship. She's the reigning champion, 145 pounds for Bellator now.
Is there any talk about a rematch, her coming back?
I got to tell you, I mean, weird things happen in this sport, but it's a stretch. That fight wasn't competitive. And I do think Cyborg's ever been as good as Amanda for whatever that's worth, but it doesn't match up well. It turns into a shootout. Cyborg's very powerful, but Amanda turned out to be a little more powerful. And I think that's a hard sell in all fairness. Look, are they the two best women? Yeah, for sure. But when a fight only lasts 61 seconds, I think it's hard to repackage it. Look, there's a reason Tyson and Spinks didn't fight a second time. And at that time, that was the biggest boxing match ever, but it was also settled.
You watch Tyson. You watch Tyson versus Spinks and you just go, we never need to see that again.
Never need to see it. What was that? I was in the sixth grade when that fight happened, 12 years old. Off the top of my head, there was three knockdowns, the final at being stopped, all in the first round, and I believe the contest was 93 seconds. Of that 93, 30 seconds was the referee counting numbers. So to your point, not a lot to see here.
Well, Spinks entered the ring with an ace bandage around his right knee, which is never a good sign. And also, right. I always tell people when it came to Tyson, I tell them the same thing. If you're ever abducted by Al-Qaeda, you got one shot. Once you get in the van, it's over. And now you're probably going to get killed out in the street, but you got one shot. Go forward. Sure. If you ever tried to hide from Tyson, if you ever tried to defend yourself from Tyson, you're in the van, and next thing you know, you're reading a prepared statement. That's the thing. You had one shot, which is wrestle the Al-Qaeda guy in the street. You're still going to get shot, but you still have that one little opening. That's how I always thought of Tyson fights. Sorry, Shaq. Go ahead.
Fantastic analogy, by the way. You deserve credit for that. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
It's funny, though, because you kind of touch on something that it seems to me that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm interested for your insights on it. It feels like football, there's an ebb and a flow. Like certain defenses know how to arrest certain offenses, and then in the offseason, the offense adjusts, and there's a back and forth cat and mouse thing that goes on over the years. It feels to me like MMA that the takeaway is that things get outmoded. A certain style, once it gets defeated, much like Michael Spinks against Mike Tyson, there's no reason to carry on. That style doesn't work anymore, and it's going to lose. And it feels progressive in an athletic sense, if you know what I mean. Is that accurate to say that?
I wouldn't disagree with that. Yeah, we'll definitely see techniques if that's more what you're talking about, the exercise. Yeah. shows of sports that sometimes will go away, but sometimes they will refurbish. They'll have a comeback where now all of a sudden they're new again. And when they become new again, then people weren't prepared defensively for them. So we will see a little bit of trade-off, but the sport of MMA is so new, in all fairness, that it is outgrowing itself at a very rapid pace. You know, I don't know that football could say the same thing, or basketball. That's been around in a lot of games and a lot of teams, a lot of studying, a lot of coaches and athletes, but MMA in many ways is in the infancy. I hear other people say, I don't know how much I believe the infancy still, but it is progressing in a very short period of time. You know, speaking of Spinks, by the way, guys, random topic, but since we're on Spinks, he never fought again after Tyson, which is every fighter comes back, right? And we all end up the same way, face down and embarrassed. Spinks got that one time. He left with some money. He had some managers that robbed him. He's in some lawsuit now. I literally just read about him 3 nights ago. But for the most part, he's got his wits, his senses, and moved on in life. Good for Spinks.
Yeah. I wish we could say as much about Leon, his older brother. And the name just popped into my head, Marvis Frazier. Remember when they put him in with Holmes? And it's one thing to get knocked out. It's another thing when the guy you're fighting is just peppering you with jabs and then also using his free arm to gesture the ref like, hey, could you please stop me from doing what I'm doing to this other human being? Like, half his attention is on pummeling Marvis Frazier and the other half is like, you want to end this or we're going to keep going? Yeah, that I don't know what Marvis Frazier, Gary, ever he must have got back in
Marvis
the ring.
Got the I think that's Trevor Burbick, notwithstanding the late Trevor Burbick, but Marvis Frazier, that might be the most severe knockout Tyson ever on anybody. I think he literally with an uppercut lifted Marvis Frazier off the ground with an uppercut that knocked him out. One of the nastiest knockouts in history.
I got to tell you guys, I thought Adam was mispronouncing Marvin Hagler when he said, I don't know who Marvis is. I follow boxing very closely. I'm not recalling Marvis Frazier, is it? I got to go look him up.
Marvis Frazier fought 3 times after Tyson, winning all of them, finished with a 19-2 record. Well, he was Joe Frazier's son. That's the reason you would probably know him. And he also fought Larry Holmes. I'm sure he fought Larry Holmes. The deal is this. His only other loss. So, all right, not too bad. You're a heavyweight boxer and you have 2 losses. And people are like, who did you lose to? Larry Holmes and Mike Tyson. Not too shabby.
Tough guy. Just to get in there, regardless of the outcome, right? I mean, many other men have tried. Many other men failed at that same duo, but you got a lot of courage in my book.
Oh, my God. Anyone who got in with Tyson during those days. And look, give Larry Holmes his due. That guy put together a huge winning streak, had a huge jab. I'm convinced that if he looked, if Larry Holmes looked like Mike Weaver with his shirt off, I used to spend some time with Mike Weaver. Mike Weaver was an Adonis. Are you guys familiar with what Mike Weaver looked like with his shirt off and his boxing trunks? He was literally an Adonis. And Larry Holmes looked like he had a little bit of a dad bod his whole career. And I think he didn't get the respect because he was kind of smooth, you know? But that jab, man, there's something about the jab, which is it doesn't work as well with the Adonis body. It works better with the smooth body, the jab. Thoughts, Chael?
I fully agree with you. And you're right. That guy did look like he was carved out of stone, in all fairness. I fully agree with you on that. By the way, you had mentioned Leon Spinks a minute ago. And I have to tell you, my favorite Leon Spinks quote of all time, he got himself a new Mercedes-Benz, used some of his purse money, bought himself a new car. And he told the media, the Mercedes-Benz is the Cadillac of the automobile.
He was
trying to be funny.
No,
I once went to a baseball game and Leon Spinks sat directly in front of me, the seat directly in front of me. And he stood up once during the game and I got to shout once in my life, down in front, the champ. It was just excellent. But Larry Holmes, Ace, I think the other thing is, just like Mr. Furley learned from trying to succeed, Mr. Roper was too much. Larry Holmes was succeeding Ali, and he didn't have a rival. The fight that I wish we could see is prime Larry Holmes against prime Mike Tyson. That fight, man, because to your point about, I mean, 6 foot five, Larry Holmes could have kept Mike Tyson at bay with that jab, I think.
Well, we learned that with Tyson, Tyson was a bully, and that's how he fought. And anyone who ever retreated from a bully was, they always, you know, you're in a 22 by 22 foot area with a rope around it. You're not going to get away. So eventually the bully walks you down and beats you. Evander Holyfield didn't let himself get bullied. He walked to Tyson. They stood in the front of the ring. Holyfield was just trading hooks with him in the center of the ring. And then, of course, famously, what's his name in Japan who beat him?
Buster
Douglas is another guy who brought the fight to Tyson. If you watch that Buster Douglas fight, he's doubling up the jab and coming right after it with the cross. And Tyson wasn't used to seeing that. Tyson was used to seeing guys back on their heels, protecting themselves, not in an offensive posture, but in a defensive posture. And what we learned about Tyson is when you bring the fight to him, he becomes human.
That's what Teddy Atlas always talked about. You know, I think Teddy Atlas and Mike Tyson have worked out some of their differences, but Teddy did tell people that, look, don't back down from the bully. As soon as somebody stands up to him, and Teddy would even break it down that it wasn't about the punches and the hooks and the jabs, and he would say it was a character issue. This guy has to be the bully in the room, and if you stand up to him, and that was a surprise with Buster, by the way. You know, biggest upset of all time, was that 9-1 or even 10-1?
I heard 50-1 before. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
As great as Mike was, or any athlete, whatever experience he has, eventually you do listen to the media. When the media tells you got an easy night, there's a part of you that believes that. And I'll tell you guys, if you ever find yourself in a battle that's harder than you thought it was going to be, that's when things can unravel very quickly.
42-1 odds. What is the great Teddy Atlas corner blowing at Sun? He's probably talking to Michael Moore at that point. He's fighting for the championship. Michael Moore is probably fighting against Holyfield at that point. But there's a great piece of footage. If you ever wanted Teddy Atlas at his best, it's him talking to Michael Moore in the corner, you know, probably the 10th round of his first championship fight. He's probably fighting Holyfield, Gary, and he's doing the, you're blowing it, son. I'm not going to lie to you. If you remember that speech, it was Chael, have you ever heard that speech?
Many times. It's on YouTube right now for any of your viewers, Adam. Yes.
All right. So screw it. We don't need to pull it up, but I love that guy. I love Teddy Atlas's passion. Not in a sexual way.
No,
say, I want to be clear. I love his passion for the sport of boxing. I love the best. Teddy Atlas is at his best when there's a bad call. You know, when someone gets a hometown decision and then they go to him next and he goes berserk. That's my favorite Teddy Atlas moment.
And Adam, I fully agree with you. And you know what? He's got in trouble commentating for that reason. Like some of the networks will say, hey, you know, you got to support the product. And Teddy will never support a product over the sport itself. He is for integrity of the sport. They quit using him for the Olympic Games because those judges were so corrupt. Teddy was right. Teddy's the one that called him out. At the last Olympics in Rio, three boxing judges were removed from Olympic Village and can never return because of corruption. They were taking money and NBC like caught it on camera. It was just terrible. Teddy was right on everything, and he always stands up for the integrity of boxing, and it hurts him, and it shouldn't hurt him. People should agree with you, Adam, that he's right for doing that.
He tells the truth, and that's helpful there. But to Ace's point too, I never understand the guys in the corner that are lying to their guy. Like, tell him, yeah, you're losing. You better win the next couple of rounds or this one's over. Why this thing? Like, you're doing great. Why not do what it seems like you're doing a disservice to your fighter when you tell him, like, oh no, everything's going all right when they're clearly losing.
The worst was Lou Duva. I think it was Pernell Whitaker, but I can't remember if it was him or not. going against an unbeaten like Julio Cesar Chavez at that point. Julio Cesar Chavez like 96-0, and he's beating him. And Lou Duva, it's the 15th round or the 12th round, whatever they had back then. It's the last round. And Lou Duva's like, you gotta get him. Go get him. He's won every round. You're about to beat the greatest fighter in middleweight history. And you tell him, take the fight to him. And you got a guy with great footwork, great movement, great head movement. That guy could have got on his bicycle, danced around for 3 minutes, walked away with the championship. I don't know if it's Meldrick Taylor or anyway, or Pernell Whitaker, either one of those guys. I can't remember which one. Duva's like, go get him. And he goes and trades. And with 8 seconds left, Julio Cesar Chavez knocks him out. Yep. Because they're trading. He had no business trading. I mean, I respect it. I appreciate it. But goddamn, there is some strategy to the sport, people.
Yeah, Adam, you're Meldrick fully right. Taylor. At some point, you don't have to beat your opponent. You just got to beat the clock. I mean, we see it in football all the time. They take a knee, run out the clock. And I think that was Meldrick. Now,
it was Meldrick Taylor, yeah.
But Meldrick was the one that was beating Julio Cesar, and the referee stepped in and called it a TKO with like seconds left, and everybody thought that ref did a terrible job. I saw what the ref saw. Whether Meldrick was winning that or not, and whether it was short time or not, he was not defending himself, and I thought Cesar won that fight fair and square, even if by the wire.
I 100% agree with you, Chael, in that it's not the ref's job to look at the clock. It's his job to look at the fight. And why are you taking that away from Julio Cesar Chavez? He's winning this fight. It's a 3 minute round. You have to stop when you stop. What if there's a rule? It's like, well, with 30 seconds left, we won't stop it. Well, then how's that fair to the guy who's beating the crap out of the other guy trying to get his hand raised with seconds left on the clock?
Sure. No, you run that thing all the way in. I still, to this day, I see what the ref saw. And even, I mean, it was very sad for Meldrick. That would have been Cesar Chavez's first loss. It would have been such a big deal and all those great things. But the rules were followed as I understand them.
And then, as to make things worse, Meldrick like, gets up with a couple ticks left on the clock. He's Lou Duva's on the corner yelling at Meldrick. And the ref's yelling, and the ref's like, can you fight or can you continue or, like, come toward me? And Lou's yelling next to him, and Meldrick, like, looks at Lou, like, what do you want? And then the ref, like, waves it off. He may have screwed him times two in that fight. Anyway, other than that, I have nothing but love for Lou Duva.
Hey, wait, I got to spin the topic of boxing, though, real fast, guys, because we're talking Mike Tyson. Mike is flirting with this comeback. And now he's even releasing to the media that he has a deal. They haven't announced it yet, but that he has a deal in place. What's your opinion? Is Mike going to box again, and would you watch?
I saw the stuff online where he looked like the old Mike Tyson throwing those combinations against the guy holding the focus pads. He looks strong. He looks healthy. I would watch that fight. I'm not sure about the fight against, you know, the 57-year-old Holyfield or some version of that. There's a version of it where I'd like to see him fight a younger guy who may be ranked but not maybe in the top five or some version of that. Or we go full P.T. Barnum and he fights the guy from Tiger King when he's paroled from prison or some version of that.
Or a tiger.
Or a physical tiger.
I also think that, you know, it's sort of like comparing Tom Brady can keep going relatively late in his athletic career like he is, better than, say, Steve Young or Michael Vick could, because Brady's asset was never speed. Same thing, Tyson, like George Foreman, his virtue is power. And so if he could, like, I wouldn't stun me if Mike Tyson knocked out a high-ranked heavyweight right now, because George Foreman was able to knock out Michael Moore. Michael Moore let his hands down for 1 second, and Tyson certainly can take advantage of that the same way Foreman could, right?
Well, it could also be argued that Tyson, when he was the Tyson of old, had a lot of distractions, a lot of women, a lot of booze, substances, God knows what. Like he didn't properly train for a lot of that stuff. A more focused, clean Mike Tyson without a lot of family and craziness and Don King distractions, really focusing on his training and his health. That might be something interesting to watch. I say he fights David Tua.
I'm in. Hey, there were talks of Shannon Briggs. I would do the Tua thing. If I was the promoter, if I had full control of this thing, I would manipulate it greatly. I'd make it 2-minute rounds. It'd be 4 rounds. I mean, I'd steer into the fact that it's a little bit of a sideshow. And you want to know who I'd book him with? I don't know if you'd like. I'd like your real reaction. You want to know who I'd put him against? Peter McNeely.
Oh, really? Of old.
I'd bring back the comeback, a redemption story for McNeely. McNeely's still a little bit younger, something to do, shorten the rounds. That's how I would do it. I wouldn't try to make believe this is something that it's not. Tyson is not make believe. Tyson is openly saying this is a cash grab, and the first person to the table with $1 million, I will sign the contract. Okay, great. If it's a cash grab, let's have some fun.
Shannon Briggs is an interesting guy. Speaking about a real big heavyweight for back in the days when heavyweights were Michael Spinks size, a little after Michael Spinks, obviously, but a big old glass of water, Shannon Briggs. All right, Chael, we could go all day with you. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end. I want to.
You're kicking me out. You know what, Adam? I've had it with both of you anyway. I have things to do. I am breaking up with you.
Thanks, Chael. Good on you. Appreciate all the info. All right, let me hit Bet Online. Nothing to bet on, right? Well, wrong. There's hundreds of events, games, props to wager on. They're even bringing the Vegas-style online poker and blackjack right to you, right to your home, 24/7. Also, bet on NASCAR, stock prices, weather, event, Nathan's hot dog eating competition. Visit the website or use the mobile device to join today. Bet Online, our exclusive partner at Podcast One. Sign up for a free account with promo code Podcast One, and you'll get your sign up bonus when you do that. So visit betonline.ag. Don't forget, use the promo code Podcast One for your sign up bonus today. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts. Right, Chael?
That's correct. And I think the correct answer here is Mike Tyson versus Carl Weathers, a.k.a. Apollo Creed. Now, that's the one I'm going to watch.
That I would watch.
All right. A Friday episode still coming your way. Before then, though, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damashek, good sports. Thanks again to Chael Sonnen. Out.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Pre-order Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's out on June 16th, and you can get the links at adamcarolla.com.